broadcasting from the shores of El Pacifico. Bill Hendrick.
The command to which he was attached over in Iraq at the time had decided to issue...
The president of the Italian-American organization Unico finds the new show offensive for what he...
No, I'm not doing it.
Go for the record.
No.
World record. Guinness Book of World Records.
The president of the Italian-American organization Unico finds the new show offensive.
Burn in hell.
World famous Phil Hendry Show every night until 1 o'clock here on the West Coast and 4 a.m. out on the East Coast. And on the East Coast, it's Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody everywhere here. This is a news, talk, and entertainment show where reality is the bitch through the looking glass we go of media and talk radio and all of that. Tonight, of course, it's crime night. It is the, well, it's usually, crime night is usually our last Friday of the month, bud. And Robert Leonard also with me here, along with Jason Rantz and Ralph Rodriguez. But it's not tonight, right?
No, I cannot. Thanksgiving, Dr. Stone will be here tonight, is my understanding.
Yes, your understanding is correct.
What are you talking about, Madam? The guy called up.
No, he's right.
I know.
So Dr. Stone will be here tonight from Investigation Discovery's Most Evil program. It's a fantastic show. It deals with the mind of people who are not just criminal, not just aberrant in their dealings with society. It deals with the minds of people who kill for seemingly no reason at all, and we get to the bottom of why it is. And Dr. Stone and Dr. Dietz, who is another prominent forensic psychiatrist, and a great many people are looking into now. This is a whole new frontier. This is the new frontier. This is why do people kill for no reason? I mean, it's easy to say, all right, a guy kills because he's a contract killer, because he works for the mafia or something like that. Somebody killed because of a crime of passion. Someone commits murder in the commission of a crime. But individuals that go out and kill for seemingly no reason, that's where we got to go with our, you know.
Yeah, they got to look into the brain of the guy and everything.
Yeah, they look at the brain, don't they?
Yeah, they do look at the brain. As a matter of fact, Dr. Stone can explain more of this, but, well, we'll get into it. Let me just tell you, our number is 877-876-PHIL. So Dr. Stone coming up here in just a couple of minutes, 877-876-PHIL. Then we have joining us on the program tonight a couple of very, very special guests. It is the, well, first of all, we're going to be talking, I believe, with Pastor William Reddick on Adam Lambert and the complaints that were received, particularly from parents who were concerned with their children viewing Adam Lambert's performance. Pastor William Reddick will talk about how perhaps this was a blessing in disguise, Adam Lambert simulating oral sex with another guy.
You're kidding.
That's what he said. Anyway, so coming up, we do have that. We're also going to be talking to Dr. Ron Turner about the global climate change emails that were hacked. Many people think now, because of these hacked emails and the contents of those emails, that the global climate warming argument is a canard. It was cooked up. It's a propaganda ploy, because some of these emails contain, at least according to the people who have seen them, they contain things that would indicate there's a strategy, a concerted effort on the part of people who are wanting to promote the idea of man-made global climate change, and that this whole thing is just, you know, it's a load, man. It's a heap and a half. So all of that's ahead on our program tonight. 877-876-PHIL is the number. While we wait for Dr. Stone, Google has apologized for results of the Michelle Obama image search. I don't know if you saw this, but apparently, originally, when you were Googling Michelle Obama's name, up came these images. You know, one of the things you could do, Google, is just don't put the images up there when the Google research comes back. When the Google search is completed, what happens these days is if you search a name, you could search my name, for instance, and you'll see my ugly kisser. And that alone...
That's scary.
That alone would scare some people. You're right. When you Google Michelle Obama's name, up come these images. One of the most popular image, and when I say popular, please understand what we're talking about, the most searched, the most accessed, the most, I don't know, I guess the most viewed image of Michelle Obama is one where she appears to be an ape or a monkey with her hair cut, but it's a monkey's face. Now, there's a couple of ways of looking at this. Not that anybody, you know, is going to listen to you, but there's a couple of ways of looking at this. Number one, I don't know where the image is from, and perhaps we should find out. It could have been originated by someone after that story appeared concerning a lawmaker who was making a joke either online, via email, or in private that Michelle Obama's ancestors were apes. You probably remember that story, bud?
I remember. That guy was saying she's an ape. That's what he said.
No, he said he was making a joke about her ancestors being apes.
Oh, that's bull. Anytime a white man make a joke about a monkey, you know he mean a monkey, a black man a monkey. There ain't no getting around that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't disagree with you, Robert. I'm just saying that that's what the this guy was saying. So there could have been someone commenting on that and creating that image, and it could have been created by some just one of our run-of-the-mill racists who, they long ago, I don't even know those guys ever had a sense of humor. One of the things about you guys out there, whoever you are, they got a real problem with blacks and Jews, you ain't funny. I mean, every time you try to be funny, you ain't funny. I mean, there's nothing more boring than unrelenting hate, and you can't make that funny. And even your little monkey images, man, just doesn't get it done. So anyway, for the most part, in the past week, when someone typed Michelle Obama in the popular search engine Google, one of the first images that came up was a picture of our First Lady altered to resemble a monkey. Now, on Wednesday morning, this racially offensive image appeared to have been removed from any Google image search for Michelle Obama. Google officials could not immediately be reached for comment, at least that's according to CNN. Maybe somebody else reached them for comment, CNN, and not you, huh? Anyway, Google faced a firestorm of criticism over this episode. First, it banned the website that posted the photo. This website, by the way, that had originally posted the photo was well known to spread all kinds of computer viruses, a very malicious site, and the site existed only to infect computers with viruses. Then when the image appeared on another website, Google let the photo stand. When a Google image search brought up the photo, an apologetic Google ad occasionally appeared above it. The ad redirected users to a statement from Google which read, "Sometimes Google search results from the Internet can include disturbing content, even from innocuous queries. We assure you that the views expressed by such sites are not in any way endorsed by Google." Not that they should have to say that, because we're talking about the raw Internet. Although, believe me when I tell you, there's a lot of people, probably the very people who would encourage thinking in terms of all conspiracy theories as valid. Yep, that's right, 9/11 truth, that's right. Suppose I said to you guys, yeah, well, maybe Google has cooked up something and they're trying to promote this thing, this Michelle Obama monkey image, and we should censor that. Oh, no, the Internet, man, there's no way you can... Oh, who knows? I mean, where there's one conspiracy, there's a million of them. The California-based company Google then explained that search results rely on computer algorithms that take into account thousands of factors. Blah, 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 blah. I tend to believe them, but when something's as offensive and as charged as this, fact is people will search her name. They search images. Even if you are somebody who doesn't find any humor in that image and finds it as hateful as I do, you're going to look at that image. You may even search that image because you want to be aware of what that image looks like. You may want to use it in some publication decrying that kind of thing, and so it's going to be a popular image. So Google took it down, I believe. The Internet was abuzz Tuesday and today with reaction to the image. Some online users demanded the photo be blocked. Why? Because it's offensive. I know it's offensive. It's a horrible image. It's the reflection of a mentality. A mentality that is using the Internet. It is a reflection of a real, live, living mentality in America. They're out there. They walk the same streets as we do. They eat at the same restaurants. These people exist. This is how they get their kicks. This is what the Internet is for. If we start fooling around with search results and we start messing around with editing or otherwise compromising material that somebody finds offensive, I got about 9 million websites I'd like you to look at, Google, before you start talking about Michelle Obama's monkey picture. There is no way to defend this heinous incident, said a Twitter user who gave his name. It's a fake name. He's from Calgary, Canada, which, right there, I'd give a fake name, too. People often claim...
What's wrong with Calgary?
I'm just kidding, man. Okay, people often claim their right to free speech to mask blatant racism and insulting bigotry and always seem to get away with it, he told CNN via email. Here in Canada, we don't allow that. People are skinned and then thrown into a frozen river. No, I'm only kidding, he said. I made that up. When it comes to issues of discrimination, hiding behind free speech just doesn't cut it. Well, if a guy yells the N-word in an airport and somebody turns around and belts him, Now you go before a judge. How come he hit the guy? Because he called me an N. Okay, well, that is kind of insightful speech. Now you got a problem. You got to suss that out with a judge. If a guy yells the N-word on the internet and someone gets so angry they demand that it be censored, there may be an argument that can be made as far, you know, accordingly, such as the internet is a place where your emotions can give way to more sober thought as you analyze the result of a search or analyze the content of a website. It is not an explosive living moment in direct physical contact with another human being. You're looking at material that is offensive, but then you have the time, you have the luxury to analyze it, to sit back, to recognize what it is. And that's why I think that's different from screaming fire in a crowded theater, calling some guy an Edward, or somebody's a lousy this and that, based upon, you know, how pointy the toes of their shoes are.
I don't get it.
I know you don't get it, man. What do you want me to explain?
Well, what do you mean about the being a free speech and everything?
If you yell fire in a crowded theater, you think it's okay to yell fire in a crowded theater?
Yeah.
No, well, no, it isn't.
No, it ain't, man. People are going to run out of there.
That's what you're supposed to do.
What if the fire is? What if the theater isn't on fire?
Then why would you yell it?
Just to get your kicks, to see a stampede occur.
Oh.
All right, so that's dangerous. But if you yell N-word or fire, or you got a picture of Michelle Obama with a monkey kisser on the internet, that doesn't necessarily mean there is going to be a resulting panic or a public emergency. What it does mean is you get pissed off. But you also have the luxury of analyzing the material and coming up with a response more appropriate than just running out of the theater. And that's my point. And that's why I don't think you should censor. We get into censoring the internet, man, forget it. You know, it was a lot of fun. It was a great 10, 15 years, however long the run was. But when they start screwing around with the content of the internet, forget it. We already know they're reading our email. We already know that they know how many messages we send. We already know that, you know, you got to understand, folks, every time you send an email, every time you go on a computer, I'm not saying them as in the case of the government. I don't fear the government when it comes to this stuff. I fear just the average, you know, excuse my language, off. Some guy out there who can hack into God knows what and steal whatever and spread it around for whatever price or whatever thrill. Those are the people I'm worried about. These people that are worried about the government and the black helicopters, man, get with it. It's the 21st century. Government, they don't even have the resources. They don't have near the resources that the average private citizen or the average private company has to jump into your computer, jump into your email, jump right into your Slacks, and see what's up, if you'll pardon the expression. All right, we've got Dr. Michael Stone next on the world-famous Phil Henry Show, 877-876-PHIL. Dr. Stone, tonight we look at Major Hassan and what screw came loose in his noggin.
Phil Henry.
Phil, and tonight we welcome on Dr. Michael Stone from Investigation Discovery's Most Evil, also The Anatomy of Evil, great book that was written by Dr. Stone. It's available at Amazon.com. You can also check out the first season of Most Evil at Amazon.com. Dr. Stone, good evening, sir, and happy Thanksgiving. How are you?
Thank you. Very fine, thanks.
Great. Any theater trips with the little lady these days? Or
well, we went to
busy?
The opera. We saw Turandot, you know, a very nice performance. That was a couple of days ago, yeah.
Not being familiar with the opera, it didn't have anything to do with killing.
Almost.
Oh, really? Okay.
A princess demanded that she would marry only a man who could solve three riddles that she would give, and otherwise the guy would be beheaded. So, of course, many men were beheaded, but the hero, Khalaf, manages to answered the three riddles correctly, and so she stuck having to marry him, but it all ends very happily.
It ends happily, okay. We wanted to talk, and maybe this will be an opera someday, we wanted to talk about the Fort Hood shootings, Dr. Stone, that took place. And the latest here that we have is that military investigators, the investigation of the November 5th shooting intensified yesterday with the arrival of two former top officials leading a Pentagon probe into what could have been done to prevent the shootings. Major Nadal Malik Hassan is accused of opening fire in a crowded facility when soldiers went to complete last-minute paperwork, and we all know the rest. So this is a fascinating story, and I'm so grateful to talk to you, Doc, because you talk with us all the time about serial murderers, mass murderers, psychopaths, psychotic people. I don't think we've ever really gotten into the mindset of, and it's kind of a gray area that everybody's debating right now. Is it terrorism? Is he nuts? Is it terrorism? He's nuts. Is a terrorist nuts? What's your first impression? Can I give you a layman's view, and then you tell me, all right?
Okay.
This guy looks like an ego case to me. He's walking around in his Muslim garb in a small Texas town. He's looking to attract attention. He's got a business card that said he's a jihadist. It sounds like he's just a real narcissist, you know? What do you think?
I wouldn't picture him as let's put it, there's narcissistic qualities in him, but that doesn't seem to be his primary thing. His primary thing is that he's a total flop as a psychiatrist, a second-rate or third-rate psychiatrist. And somebody who's 39 years old from Muslim culture, not married, we don't know whether he's gay or just super shy, unable to make friends with women, and didn't make friends with men either. So he was a failure, as is the case with many mass murderers. Most of them are failures at whatever they were trying to do. And it culminated in him. It's a long story, you know, but after the death of his parents, he became more involved in fundamentalist Islam, and unlike his some apparently more successful younger brothers. And mind you, he was born in Virginia. It wasn't as if he was born in Ramallah, where his parents were born in Palestine. So, but he became more under the influence of extremist imams like that fellow Al-Laki. And that became the answer to his failure in life. In other words, he converted himself from a failure that other people thought of as second rate. Obviously, he could never make it as a psychiatrist, because a psychiatrist is supposed to be able to treat people of all different national groups and religious groups and ethnic groups and everything, and be fair-minded about all of them. He couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and finally, you know, as the impending failure, you know, of his life begins to mount to a crisis portion, he then forms a plan. By no means was the man insane. He buys a gun. He gives all his things away. He's contemplating being a suicide bomber. You know, absolutely intending to die. Gave all his life possessions away. He gave a lot of money, you know, to Pakistan, probably to jihadist groups, because he lived very humbly, despite making a reasonably decent salary, six-figure salary. And absolutely intended, like all mass murderers, you know, who expect to be killed by the police or by the authorities. Of course, he was shot six times, but unfortunately, he survived.
Yeah. Well, you say unfortunately. Let me ask you about the mindset of someone who believes he's going into an act that will eventually end in his death, and he doesn't die. His grand plan of martyrdom or whatever it was that he thought would happen doesn't happen. He's going to be sitting in an open courtroom. The American people will be staring at him. They'll be looking at this loser, because that's what you're describing here.
Right.
What's going through his mind now that he has survived this?
Well, he may be a bit bitter that he survived, but I suspect he would retain, you know, his extreme views, and feel that he was being condemned by a court full of infidels, you know, Jews and Christians, infidels who were condemned in certain passages in the Quran, and he would feel, you know, that lofty and superior to all those, and so he would convert his feelings of depression, failure, being a flop and nothing, into being a superior person. There's the narcissistic twist that you're talking about. He elevates himself and compensates, you know, for feelings of inferiority, which were quite genuine, into feelings of fake superiority, you know, by imagining himself like he's got the answers. He became a jihadist.
Yeah. You know, I got a million questions about this guy, and I think the audience is really fascinated to know the mindset, because there's an ongoing debate here in talk radio, Dr. Stone, about whether this guy is a terrorist, meaning I guess we affix to terrorists a large political scheme to dominate a society, or whether he is a Charles Starkweather or a somebody like that. You know what I mean? So let's hold that thought, and we'll talk about that when we come back on the other side with Dr. Michael Stone. We're going to talk about losers in society, what makes them murderers, and also this idea of repressed homosexuality. When does it become murderous? 877-876-PHIL is our number, but we're with Dr. Michael Stone when we come back.
Phil Hendry.
Dr. Michael Stone joins us for our crime night tonight, and we're having it a little early because the Thanksgiving weekend is ahead, and the next week, obviously, we're in a new month, and Dr. Stone from TV's Most Evil on Investigation Discovery every Thursday night at 9 on Investigation Discovery here on the West Coast. Dr. Stone, we're talking about this guy, Hassan, the psychiatrist, the Army major who committed this atrocity at Fort Hood, 13 dead people. And you were talking about him being a failed psychiatrist, a man who was very socially inept, a man who is a loser, to put it as simply as possible. Now, the world is full of a lot of underachieving people, frustrated people. And we get back to the same question that we get to with every criminal, every kind of criminal act. What causes a man like this, as opposed to the run-of-the-mill schlub that just can't make anything right in his life, what causes him to commit murder? And what is that related to?
Well, you asked whether he's a terrorist, and the fact of the matter is, yes, he's a terrorist. What's different about Hassan is that he's homegrown, and he's, as far as we can tell, not closely allied with any other group of people. In other words, he was not like the 19 that flew the planes into the World Trade Center in Pennsylvania and the Pentagon. He was not closely connected with some group in Al-Qaeda. He didn't train in Afghanistan. He was somebody, a person from, obviously, Islamic background, who began to harden and, as I say, compensate for his failure by becoming more extreme in his views. And then the point is that in his case, the religion really is a very important factor. As I've told many people talking about this, I lectured out in Sacramento a couple of days ago about Hassan and among other topics. And I said that most of the people in our country, most of the Jews and Christians in our country, grow up with what you might call a sprinkling of, we're sprinkled with religion. We're not drenched with religion, except for maybe some evangelical Christians and very ultra-Orthodox Jews. Most of us don't get drenched in religion the way so many Muslims do, particularly from the countries Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Iran, Palestine, Afghanistan, and he comes from Palestinian parents. So religion is an extremely vital part of their upbringing. And since Khomeini 30 years ago took over Iran, there's been this wave, as I need hardly tell you, of extremism in the Islamic world. And he got caught up in that. And so that justifies the anger and rage that was boiling up in him because of his failure. And the philosopher Blaise Pascal said 300 years ago, he said, men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. Very important comment. So it's the connection between his psychological difficulties and sense of failure and the need to compensate and overcome that, where there's this ready handle in the extreme form of Islam, that the two flow together and made him what he is, the terrorist who finally decided commit suicide in a blaze of glory, quote-unquote, in his mind, by killing these infidels in his mind. By the way, there was 14
14.
Because one of them was a pregnant woman. So it's 12 mm-hmm. people and a pregnant woman. And the reason I mm-hmm. emphasize 14 is because there's a very strong parallel between him and this fellow Gamil Gharbi, or who took the name Mark Lapine in Canada, yeah. in Montreal, who killed 14 women.
Now, this guy, Lapine, this guy Lapine you're talking about, he was 25 years of age. He was from Montreal. He murdered 14 women and wounded 10 women and 4 men, and then killed himself at a polytechnic engineering school. Tell us about this guy and what his motivation was.
Well, his motivation was that these guys always have some excuse as to why they are the failures they are. In the case of Lapine, who took the name Lapine, by the way, after his mom divorced his very violent Algerian father. His original name, last name, was Gharbi, and his father was very abusive, and parents finally divorced when he was 7. But he grew up as a person that just couldn't get along with others. He tended to be violent, and he blamed women, which would hitch up with his Islamic background, as being the reason the women should be just doing stuff in the kitchen, having babies, and cooking. The idea that women were taking jobs, going to school, becoming something, that infuriated him because they were taking men's jobs, such as Mark Lapine's job, away from him. That's how he saw it. And so when he lost a job, he was practically homeless. And finally, when the rage built up to what Dr. Wortham called a catathymic crisis, where you're just exploding with rage and you're just looking for a solution, and murder seems to be the solution, and when you kill what you think of as your enemy, then
yeah.
you settle down. Some of them then feel okay. Others kill themselves in the process. But that was what was motivating him. So again, a different aspect of Islamic life, where women are not supposed to be the equal of men, was something that he latched onto as the reason, for A, his failure, and B, his solution, which was, by golly, to go into school where all these girls were learning things and kill as many as he could.
Yeah. Now, we're talking to Dr. Michael Stone from Investigation Discovery's Most Evil Show. Dr. Stone's book is called The Anatomy of Evil. It's fantastic book, and you can pick up Most Evil at Amazon.com. Dr. Stone, so what you're saying here is that these people, coming from this psychological place of deprivation or self-loathing, become members of any kind of society that seems to encourage or allow this sort of lashing out? I mean, could we make this comparison between these guys? Could we make a comparison between them and the Manson family, this group of losers that were empowered by this little messiah to go out and commit mayhem in the name of their little society? Is it the same kind of thing?
Yes, there is a similarity there, except that the groups, in other words, Manson had a group of a couple dozen followers, people who were runaways, failures, lost people, lost souls, that he mesmerized. So there was a smaller group, whereas Hassan was felt himself to be a good Muslim, part of a 1.3 billion strong Islamic
sure,
community,
yeah.
and the same with Lapine. So the backing that they had and the justification for doing what they did would be stronger in Hassan and Lapine because they had an entire religion that they could understand in a twisted way as justifying, their murderous actions.
Yeah. I was going to ask you a question, though, and this goes to the idea of socializing within a society. In other words, you mentioned that this guy, Hassan, his parents were, I believe, Palestinian, did you say, or Lebanese?
Originally, yes, they came from Ramallah.
Originally.
Near,
right.
North.
So he had, yeah, so he had foreign-born parents. Now, is there a difference, the Muslim that he was, who was raised in a home that was overseen by Muslim immigrants, is there a difference between him and the homegrown Muslim, the all-American Muslim whose parents were American, who is an American? And in other words, there's a mitigating factor there. The country, America being what it is, emphasizing this separation of church and state, so on and so forth, as opposed to, say, Great Britain, where they say people don't really get socialized in Britain. People don't really become a part of that society. So it's easy to become, it's easy to maintain your insular state. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Would you expect this from an American of many generations Muslim?
There wouldn't be very many Muslims of many generations from the Arab countries. There would be some, especially from Lebanon, where, of course, many Lebanese are Christian to begin with, but there are Syrian Muslims, there are Lebanese. There are not very many fourth and fifth generation Muslims in our country. And the ones that would be might very well be highly Americanized and take their religion much more lightly. For example, I have colleagues in my profession, heads of chairman of departments in psychiatry in various cities, outstanding researchers, you know, who come from Muslim backgrounds, but they take it with a, you know, in a much more light way. They're not, as I say, drenched in it. So that they're not very different, you know, at all, you know, from Americans of, you know, Christian and Jewish background.
Right.
Then there are of course, some black Muslims, you know, who span the whole spectrum, you know, between very righteous and deserving people, like as Malcolm X became, all the way, you know, to those who are in prison and become radicalized, and when they are released, you know, are susceptible of violent actions because they begin to feel that, again, compensating for their own previous bad records and sense of inferiority, that now everybody else is evil or bad. You know, the whites are evil, the Jews are evil, whatever. So,
yeah.
That group.
Well, I know we got a lot of names that you mentioned to us, Doc, and are kind of preparing for the show. We've got not only Mark Lapine and Major Hassan, we have Colin Ferguson, Patrick Birdie. I want to talk to you about a couple of these people.
Sure.
As we talk to Dr. Michael Stone tonight about the loser mentality, when does it become a murderous mentality? And I want to get into just that little thing you mentioned, too, about the possibility of a repressed homosexuality, what that has to do with any kind of violent act. Our number is 877-876-PHIL, coming up next hour, of course. We've got more with Ron Tarner, and we'll have Pastor William Rennick, the world-famous Phil Hendry Show with Dr. Michael Stone, Crime Night.
Phil Hendry. Listening to the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Every night till 1 o'clock here on the West Coast, 4 a.m. on the East Coast, and with us, it's late, and we have Dr. Michael Stone. I always imagine Dr. Stone sitting in this marvelous library with just shelves of books reaching to the sky and a ladder that's leaning against the bookshelves, and it's dark, and there's musty documents, and you just spend the night going over the lives of these just strange people, Dr. Stone.
Exactly correct. I'm sitting in a study with 2,000 books and many documents.
That's awesome, man. I got to tell you, I'm going to be in New York in March. You know, I got to take you to dinner or something, man. You know, I would love to do that. Dr. Stone, one of the things that Jason mentioned to me during the break, and I do want to ask you, we've got a lot of talk going on these days now after the Fort Hood shootings. You've been talking a lot about this man, Hassan, his personality, his upbringing. Is there such a thing as warning signs? I know we live in a world where we want everything to have a warning label or at least some directions. Here is what you do if there is a potential murder. Do you have any ideas on this? Is there a way of looking at a coworker or a friend and seeing something beginning to get serious in their personality?
Oh, yeah. The question is what to do about it. There were warning signs with Hassan, you know, the fact that he was trying to convert other soldiers and acquaintances, you know, to Islam, and that he was going around saying that he didn't really like our constitution. He thought that Sharia, the Islamic law, should, you know, supersede the constitution. I mean, and people complained about it, but, you know, we live in a culture, even since 9/11, where people pussyfoot around the Muslims as though, well, it's their religion, we shouldn't say anything about it. And so the complaints died on the vine. They didn't go anywhere, but there were a lot of warning signs. There were warning signs with Colin Ferguson that shot up the people on the Long Island Railroad. He was a guy
yes.
that had a lot of sharp edges in his personality. He was always talking about wanting to kill whites. Buford Fuhrer was talking about, in Seattle, killing Jews and black people, and mm-hmm. getting into a lot of trouble and sometimes being arrested for expressing these views or acts of violence against groups. Fuhrer was a member of the Aryan Nation, a neo-Nazi group. So there was all
right.
kinds of, and he was in jail for a couple of years. But then they said, well, he's got some treatment. He's better now. We'll let him out. So, yes, there's warning signs, and a great many of them.
How do you treat somebody like that, Doc? If you got a Buford Fuhrer in front of you, if you got a Colin Ferguson or this guy, Hillel Hassan, what would be your approach with this individual?
Tough assignment.
What miracle would you perform?
Well, Colin Ferguson is as militant and paranoid today as he was in the 90s when he committed the murders on the railroad. That I hear, and as a matter of fact, he got into a vicious fight with a serial killer, Joel Rifkin, over something, and they punched each other out. So he would be untreatable, and absolutely. So you just have to keep him confined and incarcerated
in
institution,
right.
and that's that. I don't really think if, let's say, somebody managed to, so some higher officer, like a colonel on the base, said to Hassan, we're not going to let you, do your duties unless you get into therapy, and we're going to assign you so-and-so, for your therapist. Now, that would be a very tough assignment because
uh-huh.
you would be trying, in effect, to get him to soften his views about his extremist views about Islam and to be more accepting of, quote, the infidel. That when you're dealing with somebody whose views are hardened to the point that his were, I think the success rate is very, very low. These are not easily treatable people. I mean, Buford Fuhrer was not treatable either. They let him out. They gave him, a little bit of medication, which, of course, he did stop taking. And even if he did take it, there's no guarantee that you would be able to make any headway with a person of neo-Nazi sentiments. Now that he's been in prison for a number of years, he says he regrets what he did. He realizes that being a neo-Nazi was, a very bad thing, and he's apologetic. I don't know how sincere. But let's say he had a transformation, but the transformation only came after the murder, not before. So some of them are salvageable after their murder and they're in prison. But to get them before and dissuade them, from doing what they did and to build up their, like in the case of Mark Lapine, to help him build up his personality so that he feels that he can, get a good job, he can make it, he can have a wife, he can take his place in society and not to have to be so resentful of women taking, quotes, men's jobs, that would be a tall order.
Yeah. Hey, Doc, it sounds to me like as advanced as we think we are and as much into the 21st century as we've gone, it sounds to me like sometimes the solution is simply putting them in jail and keeping them there, and that's where that's at, or the death penalty if one is so guided. But it sounds like sometimes a cage is the ultimate treatment for some
of these
people.
That's right, but we're not communist Russia, so we don't have protective detention. In other words, Buford Fuhrer, having expressed his desire to kill Jews and blacks and having got into violent scrapes, etc., before he committed the attempted murder of the Jews and killed that one Filipino postman, you couldn't have put him away just because of his views forever. Once he kills somebody, then you can put him away for a long time. So without protective detention, it's very difficult to head these guys off at the pass. Once they've done their murders, then you can throw away the key, but not before.
We got a couple of minutes. Men, Harvey Milk said to a colleague of Hill's, Cleve Jones, watch out for Dan White. He is in the closet. Those guys are dangerous. This is quoted in the Mayor of Castro Street. It seems that Harvey Milk recognized, at least he felt, Dan White was some kind of a closeted homosexual and was enraged by that. These are violent, potentially violent men, aren't they? And you mentioned Hassan possibly
being this kind of individual?
Well, he comes across as being, let's say, unself-confident about his masculinity, whether he's gay or straight, I don't know. The fact that he was 39, coming from a culture where you're expected to be married, you know, much younger. I remember when I was in Pakistan years ago, I went to, you know, as a guest, a different wedding every night, and the girls were 15, the grooms were 18. I suppose over here that would be statutory rape, but over there that was when they married very young. And to be 39 and approaching 40, see, that's already like a critical point in his life. Oh, he's going to be 40. And therefore, the feeling of being a failure would get increasingly acute.
Enhanced.
With every month. You don't want to say that every person, you know, who is gay and uncomfortable with his homosexuality is a potentially violent
person.
That would be absolutely untrue. But there's a certain.
But it was a red flag. Yeah, it was a red flag
like
in his case.
Randy Kraft, San Diego's serial killer.
Yeah, we got to go, Doc. We got to go. I'm so sorry. I'll see you next month, brother. Thank you,
Phil Hendry,
Dr. Stone.
Learn more at talkradionetwork.com.